be back here at PI, and in particular in this room. It really is great to be back here. So I'll be speaking about, I'm not sure how far along the toward part I'm going to get, but I'm certainly going to talk about the AGT correspondence. So AGT stands for Aldai, Gyoto, and Tachikawa. And I'm sure everyone here knows what this is about. I'm just going to very, very generally and briefly say that this is a correspondence between two theories. And in just very, very broad strokes, that the two theories involved are 4D n is equal to 2 gauge theory for UR. So R would be called the rank of the theory. So this is theory one. And theory two is a particular conformal field theory, just called AR minus one, Toda field theory. So it's for this particular Lie algebra. And if you're a mathematician like me, you think of this as being the representation theory. Well, you could think of it in any way, I'm sorry. But I mostly think of this as a representation theory of the algebra, the W algebra of type GLR. We could argue about whether this should be SLR or GLR. I actually prefer GLR here. The W algebra of GLR is the symmetry algebra of the Toda field theory. So what can we say about this? Well, I will summarize 10 years of history in two short and very vague sentences. So the bulk of interest in this correspondence over the last decade was due to physicists who, well, I should not generalize, but I should say that they mostly, or arguably. Sorry, I keep forgetting I'm in a mathematical physics department. All right, studied his correspondence at the level of identities of partition functions. So studied the correspondence at the numerical level. So they were interested in computing the partition functions of these two sides and of comparing them. So in the case of A2, which I actually think was the first one to be studied by the original authors, the left-hand side, the partition function of the left-hand side should be the Nekrasov partition function for R4 with the omega background partition. And the right-hand side should be conformal blocks for the W algebra, which I mentioned. So in terms of the partition functions, you can think of this correspondence as the equality between a certain Nekrasov partition functions and certain conformal blocks for the W algebra. Now, mathematicians like myself have mostly tackled this problem from a different angle. So mathematically, a lot of interest has been devoted to the algebra-geometric incarnation of this correspondence. So much interest has gone into the case when the fourfold here is something from algebraic geometry, and that something is an algebraic surface. When the fourfold of gauge theory is, let's call it S, and let's think of this as an algebraic surface over C, say. So the base case is when it is equal to C2, the affine plane, but the point of this talk would be to try and can think about what happens for more general surfaces. So I should say right now that mathematically, what we do is we study gauge theory. I should not even say mathematically, I should say from an algebra-geometric viewpoint, we study gauge theory by replacing instantons with sheaves. So we replace instantons cont S as a four-dimensional real manifold with sheaves, so with algebraic sheaves on S regarded as a two-dimensional complex manifold. Is this actually visible? I probably should not go any lower than this. Okay. So this is in broad strokes what I will study, an algebra geometric incarnation of the HCT correspondence, which is fairly well understood with some caveats that I will soon explain when S is the plane, or say, well, when S is the plane. There are different levels of understanding. So let me recall a little bit of the history of a little bit of the mathematics behind this. I will not even attempt to go through the physics of this really big subject. So some of the history. As far as I know, a very big chunk of work on the mathematical incarnation of HCT was due to Aulick and Okunkov, and independently to Shiffman and Vassero. Who had two different treatments for the pure theory and the theory with fundamental matter. These are the matters which go into the gauge theory. And my own contribution to this was the case of bifundamental matter. Plus the deformation of all of this correspondence from the 4D n is equal to 2 to the 5D n is equal to 1 gauge theory, which corresponds to replacing S, which is a real fourfold, by S times a circle. Okay. I should say that these three approaches were all different. So today I will naturally develop on the third approach, which you know is mine, so it's what I want to talk about. Approach number three, which has the following feature, is based on intersection theory. And because it's based on intersection theory, it works for arbitrary surfaces and doesn't really care about the fact that your surface is the plane. Essentially, the same computations and proofs you have to do in the plane case, if you do them right with intersection theory, you may generalize them to arbitrary surfaces. So this should work, and I'll give you some statements as to the a degree in which should work actually works for general surfaces S. Now, why would you care about a general algebraic surfaces S? Or in other words, what does this add to the problem? Well, in the words of an important physicist whose name I will not say, I'm coming from the US right now, and in the US, it's a big thing to protect your sources nowadays and to make sure that they stay anonymous. So I will do the exact same thing. What that person said is that a lot of the physics interest has gone to the case when S is the plane or a toric surface or that kind of stuff, because these are cases when the partition functions could actually be computed. You have techniques like equivariant localization, which allows you to put certain big sums into a computer and actually compute the partition functions of these two sides and see that they are equal. For a general projective algebraic surface, you cannot expect something like this to happen. You can expect some numbers, but those numbers are not going to be given by any simple formula, and it's not clear how to compute them explicitly. So what we will do is we will use these intersection theoretic techniques to not compute the partition functions, but to prove the correspondence in a theoretical way. So that's what this method adds to the problem. It allows you to say something for a general surface, even if it's not something that gives you an actual value for your computation. All right, so that much has been an introduction. If there are any questions, I'll start moving on to the mathematics, because this has been pretty general stuff. All right, so let's actually start with some definitions. So let S be a smooth projective surface over C. And inside this surface, let's consider an ample divisor H. Let me start with the definition of the moduli space where everything happens. So definition one, let M, Hilbertian, be the moduli space of H stable sheaves on the algebraic surface S with topological invariance as follows. A given fixed rank, a given fixed at arbitrary Hern class. Oh, I should say that I call my sheaves F throughout this talk, but potentially varying and arbitrary second Chern class. So you will see why this is important. In a sense, I'm fixing a rank, and this is actually fundamental to the problem because the rank R should be the same R which appears here and here. But the reason why I'm fixing the first Chern class is that nothing which I do in this talk will actually change the first Hern class. Only at the end, when I will start talking to you about hopes and dreams, will we think about things that change the first Chern class. But for the time being, we can actually assume that this moduli space has fixed R and fixed Chern class. Now, I should say what H stable means. So a sheaf is H stable if for any subsheaf G proper, we have PGN less than PFN for N large enough, where PG and PF are reduced Hilbert polynomials of the sheaves G and F, and they are defined as, well, I'll define it for F. So PF of N is the following polynomial, the dimension of the space of sections of the sheaf F twisted by N times the ample divisor H. So this is the only time in this talk when the ample divisor H will be important, divided by a rank R. So this is a definition of the Hilbert polynomial. It's a fact of algebraic geometry that the right-hand side of this expression, when N is large enough, gives you a quadratic polynomial in N. And because we divide by R, this is actually a monic quadratic polynomial in N. So in saying that one reduced Hilbert polynomial is less than another, you're essentially saying some inequalities for their linear terms and their free terms. So that's what H stability means. All right, so this is the moduli space where the action will happen. Here are the two assumptions which I make of this moduli space. So the assumption one is actually an assumption on the surface. So we assume that either the canonical class of the surface is trivial, the canonical line bundle is trivial, so omega s refers to canonical line bundle, and os, it refers to the trivial line bundle. So either this happens, or the first Chern class of the canonical bundle intersected with the ample divisor H is negative. So this is a cohomology class of degree one. This is a homology class of degree one. Taking, you can compare them and you get a number. If that number, which is actually an integer, is negative, then this condition is satisfied. And the reason why we care about his condition is that either of these two options implies that the moduli space M is smooth. And you know, for a lot of reasons, it helps having a smooth moduli space. It's not absolutely fundamental to what is going on here, but if you didn't have M as a smooth moduli space, instead of doing intersection theory and algebraic geometry, you would have to do derived algebraic geometry with all the complications that stem from that. So I'm assuming this to not obscure what's actually happening behind a lot of details. This is assumption one. Assumption two is a condition on the invariant. So let us assume that the GCD of the rank R and the first Chern class of our sheaves, which remember is fixed, dotted with H, we assume that this thing is one. So this is an integer. This is an integer. We assume that they are coprime. The reason why we assume this is because this condition is not an if and only if, but it implies that the moduli space M is nice. It implies that M is projective. So in that case, you could ask stuff like the volume of M, and you can get a number, and that is extremely useful. But even more importantly than M being projective, it's a fine moduli space. So it means that there exists a universal sheaf. Now let me recall what a universal sheaf is. M is a moduli space which parametrizes some geometric objects. Having a universal sheaf means that there is something on M times S, namely a big sheaf called U on M times S, with the following property, that above any point of M, and remember that the points of M parametrize sheaves F, if you take the fiber of this U above any point in M times S, this is a surface inside M times S, the fiber is exactly F itself. So the universal sheaf is some object on M times S which glues the sheaves that the moduli space M parametrizes. And the existence of this universal sheaf is absolutely fundamental to the constructions that I will do. A universal sheaf is not unique. It is unique only up to tensoring with a line bundle coming from M. So that means that all the constructions in this talk will, all of the algebraic structures which I define in this talk will essentially be defined up to conjugation by tensoring with a line bundle. So that is the ambiguity that is inherent in this choice. So we make these two assumptions. And what exactly it is that we will study? Well, here it is. The main object of study is the following. So let M, because we let the second Chern class vary, the moduli space M will be a disjoint union of components which are indexed by the second Chern class. So what this means is that MC2 is the moduli space of sheaves whose second Chern class happens to be C2. So here, if you have M sub 5, you put in that component of the moduli space those sheaves with second Chern class equal to 5. Now, I'm not saying that these moduli spaces are themselves connected. I'm just saying that M is clearly the disconnected union of these moduli spaces here. Then, the most important object of today's talk will be following abelian group called Km, which is defined as the direct sum over all C2 integers of the algebraic K theory of M sub C2. So I'll say in a second what algebraic K theory is. If you will decide that you don't like it, you can think of everything here as being cohomology and not much will be lost. Everything in this talk will still hold if you replace K theory by cohomology, up to some changes in some formulas. This is an abelian group. You can make this abelian group into a vector space by tensoring it over Z with Q. So now it's a Q vector space. We just killed the torsion. And this thing is actually necessary for some technical parts of my proofs to hold. So we have to tensor with Q. All right, so let me tell you now what algebraic K theory is. So this is, by definition, the, let's say, the free abelian group generated by symbols curly brackets V, where V is a vector bundle bundle on MC2 for arbitrary C2 modulo the following relation. The relation is that the class of a vector bundle V2 is equal to the class of a vector bundle V1 plus the class of a vector bundle V3 if there exists a short exact sequence like this, V1, V2, V3. So in other words, K-theory is an abelian group which identifies the vector bundle in the middle of a short exact sequence with the sum of the vector bundles on the sides. You'll notice that I said a vector bundle here, and I said algebraic K-theory. This subsumes the fact that we are only talking about algebraic vector bundles here. So those are vector bundles whose coordinate changes are given by algebraic functions, so rational functions. You could have, say here, instead of VV, a topological vector bundle, in which case the changes of coordinate charts will be continuous functions, and that would give you a different group. But because this is algebraic geometry, we only care about those vector bundles which happen to be algebraic. So everything in this talk will be algebraic. Okay, so this is where the action will be happening in this talk. So let's do one more thing. Let's take two copies of the moduli space M, and let's call them M and M prime. And the reason why I'm using different notations for them is because, well, first of all, they will play different roles. And second of all, a priori, they could have a different choice of C1. So they may correspond to different choices of C1s. But the same R. That's actually extremely important for my theorems to work, is these have to be the moduli spaces of rank R sheaves for the same R. But the first Chern class of these sheaves are allowed to be different. So what can we do with two copies of this moduli space? Well, we can introduce something which is called the Karlsson-Okunkov vector bundle. So it's not really a vector bundle. It's more like a K-theory class. Karlsson-Okunkov vector bundle. So I'm using the term vector bundle here loosely. But it is something that lives on the product of these two moduli spaces. It depends on a choice of chem, which is a line bundle on S. So if you think of the case when S is equivariant C2, then this M is the same thing as a complex number. But if you think of S as being a smooth projective surface, then M is an element in the Picard group of S. So you can think of this as, well, some element in the K-theory of S, if you will. But it has to be a line bundle because it has to be invertible. So this so-called vector bundle on M times M prime, I will describe it to you by its fibers. So if you want a fiber over a pair of points here, well, a point here is a sheaf F. A point in here is a sheaf F prime. So you have two sheaves on the surface S. What can you do if you have two sheaves and you want to get a vector space? Because, you know, the fiber of a vector bundle should be a vector space. Well, you take some space of sections or some home between these two sheaves, and this is exactly what they do here. So the fiber over here is R gamma of M minus R hom F prime F tensor M. So what's happening here exactly? I'm not taking the spaces of homes. I'm taking the spaces of derived homes. So because of that, the fiber over here will not be a vector space. It will naturally be a difference of vector spaces. So in other words, a K-theory class. This part here is essentially a constant because it doesn't depend on the choices of F and F prime. It's a constant that we put in there for normalization. And well, this our home part is where the meat is, and that is what will make this vector bundle be an interesting object. So what can we get if we have a vector bundle on the product of two moduli spaces? Well, you can remember that the product of two moduli spaces has projection maps. Let's call them pi1 and pi2 to the individual moduli spaces. And we can use this vector bundle to get an operator on K-theory. This operator will be called by, will be denoted by k sub m. By my choice of convention, it goes from the kth here of m prime to the kth here of m. It's called the Karlsson-Okunkov operator, and it is given by, well, essentially the only intersection theoretic formula you can do if you have this product, these two maps, and this vector bundle on it. The definition is a sub m is pi 1 lower star exterior power of m. It's not quite the only thing you can do, but it's the only natural thing you can do. Pi 2 upper star. So the only thing I should define here is the fact that this object is the sum from I is equal to 0 to infinity, minus 1 to the ith wedge power of E. And the fact that we take the alternating sum of these wedge powers, well, it's that's what works for a very important reason, that this exterior power here is multiplicative in E. But in any event, the thing I'm writing here is an operator from the k-theory of m prime to the k-theory of m. So even if you do not, even if you have not studied the pullback and push-forward maps in k-theory, think of this as being cohomology. If you had the cohomology of m prime, you could pull back to the cohomology of the product. You could multiply by anything, by any class on the product. In this case, you multiply by this particular exterior power. And then you could push forward down this projection map and get something on m. So that's called the correspondence in mathematics. It's the fact that you can use classes on the product to get operators from the cohomology or k-theory of this space to the cohomology or k-theory of this space. All right, so what does all of this have to do with gauge theory? Well, for gauge theory, the operator, well, first of all, the Abelian group Km plays the role of the Hilbert space of the theory. And the operator A sub m, it encodes the contribution of bifundamental matter. I can actually be even a bit more precise, but let me actually write this down first. So this encodes the contribution of bifundamental matter to the gauge theory. So in particular, say you had a quiver. Say you had a gauge theory for a cyclic quiver, and you put n masses in a circle. Then the partition function of that particular cyclic quiver gauge theory would be given by composing n operators such as am. If you had different masses m1, m2, dot, 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 mn, you would compose the operators a sub m1, a sub m2, a sub mn, and then you take a trace. And if you do that operation, you would get the partition function of cyclic quiver gauge theory. So the m here plays the role of the mass, the high fundamental mass hypermultiplet. So this has been the introduction to the algebra-geometric part of the gauge theory side of the AGT correspondence. If there are any questions, I'll move on to something a bit different, but not so different. So, yes?
When you say the Hilbert space, you don't really mean the Hilbert space in the finite
theory. Well, it's not much to say this is a motivation thing. So Km is a deformation of the Hilbert space in the 4D theory.
Well, I think it's literally true it is a Hilbert space for the theory of one dimension higher.
Oh, not in 5D?
Well, if you were doing the cohomological version, this would be the Hilbert space of 5D.
Yes.
Theory.
Uh-huh.
And then in the trace, you're going down to four dimensions
again. I think maybe you could explain this to me at some point. Sure, okay.
Just to clarify this.
Sure. Yeah, okay. So then I should change this equality sign here by saying that this is related to. Any other questions?
I have a question. Do we understand a broader class of operators, maybe taking us outside of bifundamental?
So the other case, which would be extremely interesting, would be the case of trifundamental matter. And for that, I do not know of an algebra geometric incarnation in the language of sheaves. There is, in a very particular case, a very particular candidate in a paper of Okunkov and Nekrasov and Carlson, but I'm not sure to which extent it's... But that is a U1 example, and I have not actually seen a derivation of the fact that it yields trifundamental matter. It's essentially, they construct geometrically an operator from the Hilbert space times the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space, and that, you know, presumably is what corresponds to the U1 incarnation of trifundamental matter. But in general, I do not know how to think of this.
So just to make sure I'm still following up, mm-hmm. what you're going to do is you want to calculate the trace of some powers of this operator.
Well, that would be if you're interested in using this operator for calculations. So that statement is true, that if you take a trace of a composition of such operators, you get the partition function of quiver gauge theory. What is actually true in a stronger sense would be that in the particular case of the plane, in which case these operators were computed, this K sub m has a basis index by partitions, and the coefficients of am, if you take the operator am and you take its matrix coefficients at a pair of partitions lambda and mu, those are exactly the contributions of bifundamental matter in the equivariant localization computation of gauge theory. So you can relate them in this language. I confess that I do not know how to derive from first principles that the contribution of bifundamental matter in gauge theory as defined with instantons actually corresponds under the instanton sheaf dictionary to this particular operator here. I'm sure it has been done in the literature in the case when S is the plane. In the case when S is a smooth projective surface, all I've seen is a mention in this paper of Carlson, Okunkov, and Nekrasov, but I have never seen a proof. So if anyone knows a proof of this fact, I would love to see it. But in the case when the surface is the plane, this is well known, especially to physicists. So everything here is about a sheaf incarnation of the gauge theory side of the correspondence. What about a CFT side? So what about a W algebra side? Well, I can give you a construction of the W algebra side. And I can also tell you what is known and what is not known and what is hoped. So let me define an auxiliary space. Is it visible if I write here? Okay. So for an arbitrary natural number n, let us consider the following space. And I will be very vague as to what I mean by space, because it's not exactly a scheme. It's a derived scheme, but you know, I'm going to sweep this issue under the rug. So Zn is the space of parameterizing not a single sheaf like the moduli space M. It parameterizes full flags of sheaves of length n plus 1. So F0 inside F1 inside dot 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 inside Fn, together with a choice of a point x on the surface, such that the following holds: the quotient of Fi plus 1 mod Fi is isomorphic to the skyscraper sheaf at the point x for all I. So remember, the skyscraper sheaf at the point x, you can think of it as being something that is equal to zero on the entire surface, except for a one-dimensional vector space sticking out at the point x. So this is a pretty bad picture of the skyscraper sheaf at the point x, for which I apologize. But it is what it is. So this is a definition of this space Zn. It comes endowed with projection maps. So you have projection maps here from Zn to the moduli spaces F. So this one remembers F0, and I'll call it P plus. This one remembers Fn, and I'll call it P minus. And I want one more projection which remembers the point X. So in other words, this is the locus of full flags of sheaves which happen to differ only at one and the same point. So F1 is a modification of F0, F2 is a modification of F1, dot, 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 Fn is a modification of Fn minus 1, and all the modifications of these sheaves happen at the same point, and that is very important for the construction. So we have this space and these projection maps, and one other thing that we have is we have a bunch of line bundles on Zn, which I will call L1 through Ln, and it's actually quite easy to define these line bundles. So if I asked you, take this space of sheaves, can construct for me n line bundles, well, you would be tempted to say, let's see what the fibers of these line bundles should be above a given point. Well, a point parametrizes a full tag of sheaves. How can I get a vector space out of such a full tag of sheaves? Well, the answer is, take the ith quotient. By assumption, the ith quotient is a length one sheaf on a surface, is what is called a skyscraper sheaf. If you take the space of sections of this sheaf, that's a one-dimensional vector space. So this would be a definition of the line bundle Li, and I can do this for any I from 1 to n. So these are called tautological line bundles because, in a certain sense, they are given to you by the fact that Zn parametrizes chains of sheaves. Just take a successive inclusion of sheaf, take the quotient, turn that into a one-dimensional vector space by taking the space of sections, and that's your line bundle. So now we have this space with a lot of projection maps and a lot of line bundles. And we will use this space to define operators. So let me actually say what they are. So for any natural number n and any integer k, we define the following operators. They are called e minus nk, e nk, and e zero k. They are all operators from the k theory of m to the k theory of m times s. And this is actually an important point, which I will get to in a second. So these are not going to be endomorphisms of the k theory group of the Hilbert space. They are going to be maps from km into something somewhat bigger. But I'll tell you in a second how to interpret this. All right, and this one here. And I'll give you formulas for them. So just like in the previous case when we defined the Karlsson-Okunkov operator, if you have a space with projection maps and some line bundles, and you want to get an operator from the k-theory of this to the k-theory of these two factors, there's not much you can do. Essentially, all you can do is play a game of pull back and push forward, and a particular game which you play is that Enk, no, it's minus Nk. This is given by P plus times Ps push forward, Ln to the K times P minus pull back. So what does this look like visually? You take an element in the K theory here, you pull it back up here. Over here, you multiply it with something. You multiply it with Li. Multiplication in K-theory, by the way, is tensor products. So remember that elements of K-theory are vector bundles. You can always take the tensor product of vector bundles, and this gives you a product structure on K-theory, just like you have a product structure on cohomology given by the cup product. So now you're up here, and you want to end up in the K-theory of M times S. Well, you might as well push forward under the product of the two maps, P plus times Ps. And that is what gives you the operator. Well, that's the operator E minus NK. For normalization purposes, ENK is going to be a little bit more complicated. So it has a prefactor, because that's how K-theory works. But I'll tell you in a second how to think of this prefactor. But aside from this prefactor, essentially Enk is just the same as E minus Nk, but you replace the roles of P minus Np plus. And instead of this line bundle here, you actually divide this line bundle by the product of the line bundles L1 through Ln to the power r. So instead of us having a single line bundle, you have a quotient of line bundles, but that's a pretty harmless operation in K theory. So I have to say exactly what this means. So what does this operator how between. It takes, my apologies. So, how to explain his prefactor here, I have to explain exactly how this operator goes. So you start from Km, and you do his procedure here, and you end in the K theory of M times S. If you are in the K theory of M times S, you can hand tensor with anything, with any K theory class over here. Minus one is just minus one. You multiply with minus one. Then you can multiply with the determinant of the universal sheaf U. So remember that universal sheaf U is a vector bundle, or precisely a sheaf on M times S. Its determinant will be a line bundle on M times S, so you can multiply with it. And omega S is the canonical line bundle. So what I'm doing here in saying that I divide by omega S to some power, I'm saying that I'm tensoring with the inverse of the line bundle omega S, and the line bundle omega S is pulled back from the S factor to M times S. So essentially, if you think that the expression here has to be an operator of multiplication on the K theory of M times S, there's not much you can do, and there's a single way in which you can interpret his expression here. And finally, K0K is something which has nothing to do with these correspondences here. E0K is just the operator of multiplication. And let me just recall one more time that multiplication in K-theory is given by tensor product. Multiplication by the kth wedge power of the universal sheaf U. So universal sheaf U is something which lives on M times S. You can take its kth exterior power. That will give you a K-theory class on M times S. And I'm just saying that this operator here, K0K, is the operator of multiplication by that particular class. All right. Well, these operators actually, at first glance, they give us something, well, they give us a generalization of something familiar in geometric representation theory. So if you take these two operators, and you take the K is equal to 0K, so if you look at E plus or minus N comma 0, these give a k-theoretic version of the operators that classically were studied by Nakajima, Krosnowski, and Baranowski. So the first two of these authors have studied them in the case when R is equal to 1, so the Hilbert scheme of the surface S, and Baranowski generalized hair construction to arbitrary R. And all of their work was in cohomology, so these operators here, which I'm defining, give you a k-theoretic version of the construction of these authors in cohomology. But that's not quite what the point is here. The point here is not that there happens to be a Heisenberg algebra among these operators. A point I want to make is that there is a W algebra among these operators. So here's a theorem. A theorem is that for any n and k, these are now in n is an integer and k is a natural number, define the following operator. This operator is a big sum. So let me write down what the big sum is. It's a sum over all, well, natural numbers n plus minus k plus minus and k naught. The condition is that n plus minus n minus is n, and k plus k naught plus k minus is k. The operator I will put here is a triple product of the operators that I have defined before, and a particular triple product which I have to put here is the following. So e n minus k minus times e 0 k naught times e n plus k plus. And there's a prefactor here which is given by a canonical bundle raised to the power k minus 1 times n plus. So this is a prefactor which I will explain in a second. But the thing which I actually think is more important to explain is, what is this an operator on? So the individual E's, they're not endomorphisms of something. They are maps from Km to Km times S. And I claim, and I will show you in a second, that this expression here is also a map from Km to Km times S. Well, this is a definition part of a theorem. A theorem is that the operators above satisfy the relations in the W algebra of type GLR. And more specifically, I'm talking about the relations in the deformed W algebra of type GLR, which was defined by Hawata, Kubo, Hodaki, and Shiraishi, and Fagin and Frankel in the 90s. Okay, what does this actually mean? Well, intuitively, you can think of this in the following way. So if it were true, and it's not true, but if it were true that the K-theory of M times S were isomorphic to the K-theory of M times a K-theory of S, so in other words, if there were such a Q-net decomposition like we have in cohomology, which we don't in K-theory, then the W n sub k's would give a family of endomorphisms of K-theory, which are indexed by the K-theory of S, of Km, which are parametrized or indexed by Ks. So in other words, what this would give would be an action of the deformed W algebra of type GLR, a tensor, the K-theory of S, on the K-theory of M. So this is an intuitive way of how to think of what this whole thing would mean if we had a Q-net decomposition in K-theory. One thing I did not explain here is what exactly is the meaning of this composition. So how do we take operators from one group to another group and compose them? Well, here is the composition formula. So if you have two operators from Km to Km times S, call these operators A and B, then the definition of A times B, which should also be an operator from the same group to the same group, is the following. Take Km, map it to Km times S by B. Then to map K here, you can't really map A because this is M times S. What you can map is A exterior product, the identity on Ks, and then you would land in Km times S times S. So essentially, all the action is happening in between this factor and these factors, and the second S just goes along for the ride. And then to end up in the K theory of M times S as you want, you have to take the identity on Km, exterior product, the restriction under the diagonal map. So delta here is the diagonal, and then you finally end up in the K theory of M times S. And you can repeat this operation as many times as possible, and in particular, if you do this operation twice, then you get a definition of what this triple product means. So this is an action, and this is an algebra geometric version of AGT.
The W algebra has some parameters. What values are these parameters?
So her parameters, which would have been called Q1 and Q2 in the omega high deformation, in this case would be the churned roots of the cotangent bundle of S. So, you know, in the equivariant case, they can be thought of as numbers, but in this case, they are just elements in the K-theory of S, which lays even more weight to the fact that the K-theory of S should be considered as a parameter ring for this theory.
There's another question. So in like the work of Nagajima and Gronowski, they said they didn't have a Heisenberg algebra tensor the cohomology. Mm-hmm. They had generators. Heisenberg, for each cohomology class, they had a Heisenberg generator.
Yeah.
So you would expect for each cohomology class, you'd have a W algebra generator.
Yeah.
That's not quite what you wrote.
Well, that is, I mean, it is what I wrote. I was just being a bit lazy. So what you What you could do here is you could take this operator and the K theory has alpha on S. You can take this operator, multiply it by I alpha on the second factor, and then push forward to the K theory of M, and that would be the generalization of their operator from the Heisenberg to the W algebra. So it's the exact same procedure which happens, which is actually not so surprising because their construction and mine is both intersection theory, just that theirs is in cohomology and mine is in K theory, and the correspondences that we consider are a little bit different. Okay, so this is one part of AGT. Essentially, I'm saying that the Hilbert space of the K theory, a Hilbert space of the gauge theory, is acted on by the symmetry algebra of the conformal field theory. Part two is to say how the operator AM gets into all of this, and this is theorem two. It says that the operator AM, which as we saw, it controls the contribution of bifundamental matter to partition function, satisfies the following relation. So his W's are the Fourier modes of some currents, which I will denote by WK of S. And these are just going to denote the sum over all n of WNK divided by x to the power n. So it goes over all integers n. When k is equal to 1, W1 of x is the generating current of the form Virasoro. When W is 2 and higher, you get the generating currents of higher and higher deformed W algebra. So you would have each of these, you would have one of these for all k between 1 and the rank r. So now I'll give you a formula for how the operator AM interacts with these W currents. The formula is the following. A times M times WK of X times 1 minus X is equal to M to the power K times WK of X gamma, I'll tell you in a second what gamma is, times AM times 1 minus X divided by omega S to the power K. All right, so what is the meaning of this? Well, first of all, this is an equality of operators from the K theory of M prime to the K theory of M times S. And remember here that the operator AM is an operator from the K theory of a moduli space called M prime to the K theory of the moduli space M. I have this new factor S in here, essentially because the W operators have an extra parameter in the K theory of S, and you get this equality of operators here, which tells you how to commute the X operator, the Karlsson-Okunkov operator, past a generating current. Now, I should say, if in the equivariant A2 case, this is a number, this is a number, and this is a number. In this smooth projective surface example, everything here is a K-theory class. So M is a line bundle on S, and therefore it's a K-theory class. Omega S is the canonical line bundle of on S, so it's a K-theory class. The definition of this gamma thing, it is given by M to the R divided by omega S to the power R times the determinant of U divided by the determinant of U prime. And I don't really want to say exactly how this fits into its formula. Suffice it to say that the determinant of U is an element in the K-theory of M times S, the determinant of the universal sheaf on M times S, and this thing is an element in the K-theory of M prime times S because it's a determinant of the universal sheaf on the other factor called M prime. But if you want just the equivariant case out of these, just think of M, gamma, and omega S as being complex numbers. So the upshot of this thing is that AM has a vertex operator property. So what do I mean by this? I mean that in the case when S is A2, property star, this is property star determines the operator AM completely. But this is not going to be true for a general smooth projective surface S. So the question now is, what can we do in order to make it true for a general smooth projective surface S? And this is a time when I will start talking about hopes and dreams. Be true for general S. So what happens for general S is that the cohomology of the moduli space M or the K-theory of the moduli space M are too big to be controlled by the operators W and K. And you can actually even see it from the definition of these operators, because the W and Ks, they only modify a sheaf at a single point. So any composition of such operators will only modify sheaves at points. And if you want something which controls the full cohomology or K-theory of the moduli space, you need to consider more general kinds of operators. And if these operators should be geometric, then maybe they should be the kind of operators which modify sheaves along higher dimensional subvarieties and not just points. So let's try to guess some operators. And the natural choice, and this I'm just going to be extremely hand-wavy about it, because there are some technical difficulties behind it which are significant. So take a one-dimensional sheaf Q on S. So e.g., a line bundle on a curve in S. You can think of this as being a smoothly embedded curve if you wish. And consider the following correspondence. Z sub C, well, C sub Q is the space of pairs of sheaves F plus and F minus such that there exists a short exact sequence F plus goes to F minus goes to Q goes to 0. So this kind of correspondence would mean that the sheaves F plus and F minus differ along the entire curve C, and they differ exactly by the line bundle, well, which corresponds to Q here, as opposed from the example in these correspondence, in which case all of the sheaves involved in this flag, they only differed at points, and it was actually precisely one and the same point. And over here, in this tentative correspondence, these two sheaves will differ along an entire line. Well, along an entire curve, I'm sorry. You can play the same game and define projection maps.
Can I think that this is a Hecke modification perpendicular to the curve or not?
I would actually say that it's a modification along the curve.
Yeah, along the curve, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what, yeah, we could call it like that. And if you have this, a natural thing to consider would be the operator F sub Q, which is an operator from the K theory of M to the K theory of M. F sub Q is given by P plus lower star composed with P minus upper star. I'm not being extremely precise here. We may have to stick in some line bundles to get a correct operator, but what I'm saying now is all at the level of, at a very vague level, so I'm not going to strive on precision. So now the question is, can we determine the operator AM by saying not just how it commutes with generators WK, but how it commutes with these new operators?
Does SAQ have a vertex operator property?
Which ones?
W.
Oh, these things?
Yes.
I don't know. And that's a very good question.
Should it be possible to somehow get it from A?
I'm not really sure what the answer to that question is. And
in the sense that if you, so if you.
So it's a very good question.
To this buff.
It's a very good question to ask exactly how these operators could fit in with the existing operators here. And the reason why this is a good question is because many people, and Avide is one of them, but I've also heard a story on the same subject from Sergei Kukov and his collaborators. Many people have thought about constructing a VOA associated to a four-dimensional manifold, and hopefully, everything here is vague, hopefully, the VOA associated to the case when the fourfold is the algebraic surface S, on one hand, it should contain the W algebra of type GLR, which I defined before, tensor the K theory of S, the thing I just mentioned. And on the other hand, it should also contain these operators kef sub q. So a statement to this to his extent has appeared in the paper of Fagin and Gukov, who claim that these kind of operators do appear in their vertex operator algebras, but I have not seen details. So a point here is that I hope that physicists can teach us what vertex operator algebra to consider so as to give the right CFT side of the HET correspondence. And then us mathematicians can say, well, now that we know what the vertex operator algebra is, let's think about what kind of geometric operators it contains. It probably has to contain these FQs. Maybe it has to contain even more general kinds of operators. And then we can think about how to prove the commutation relations between KM and the generators of this bigger vertex operator algebra. And in the last minute, if I may, I want to show you what the analog of this computation would be for these operators called F sub Q. So this here would be proved analogously with a second theorem up on the board on the left. So modulo technical difficulties,
which are significant.
And I don't want to talk about these now. It would take me a couple of hours to list all the technical algebraic geometric difficulties which go into making this precise. We should expect such a commutation relation. So the commutator of AM with these operators FQ should be given by the following kind of formula. I'm just going to write the formula and stop. So the formula is that here you take the residue at z is equal to 0 and infinity of the following expression. So you put the operator AM here, and here you multiply by the exterior algebra of R hom from the sheaf Q into the universal sheaf tensor the line bundle M, comma z. I can explain what this means if you want, but maybe it's not really so important. And then here we put R hom from U to Q dual. So these are both operators on KM of multiplication by some tautological class. So what I'm claiming with this relation is that the Karlsson-Okunkov operator, which encodes the contribution of bifundamental matter, is given by taking the operator and multiplying it on the left with a tautological class, on the right with a tautological class, which are functions in this variable z, and then you take a certain residue by certain tautological classes. And in representation theory, this is called having a Whittaker property, because you are defining an operator by the property that its commutation with the creation operator is given by its multiplication with certain diagonal operators. But of course, since I don't know what the algebraic structure is over here, I cannot actually make this precise into a Whittaker property. All I can hope is that we can shed some light on the structure of this vertex operator algebra and the way this W algebra and these new operators fit in. And maybe even, if we need some more operators in this VOA, what the correct choices are. Thank you so much, and I apologize for going over time. Yes.
So if you do C2, the resolution of the AD singularity, you're mm-hmm. supposed to find a part fermionic vertex algebra?
Right, so in that case, I have not done computations because, to be honest, I've only been started thinking about this part. In that case, these operators were suggested by Nakajima a long time ago. I think it was maybe 10 or 15 years ago. But he defined them in cohomology, and for the following reason. Defining these operators properly in K-theory is very difficult because it's not really clear what this correspondence should be, whether it should have a DG structure, how to properly define the pullbacks and push forward under these maps, and all of these complications. In cohomology, he just said, take a locus of such sheaves and take the closure and use that as a correspondence. And even in that case, I still think there are some technical difficulties in behind proving a property of this form. But supposing that one surmounts those technical difficulties. In that case, in the ADE singularity case, this property here says that the operator AM has a certain commutation relation with as many W algebras as you have, as you have Higgs points in your ADE. And over here, you would have a commutation relation between AM and the affine Lie algebra, which Nakajima introduces. And I suppose, in that case, it seems intuitively pretty clear that this should define the operator AM completely. But I don't have a proof of this fact.
And these should generate the power, together should generate the power fermionica.
Once again, I don't have a proof of this fact, but it is to be expected.
I mean, the power fermionic algebra is an extension of polar.
So. Yes, exactly, of the W algebra by this Lie algebra. And in that case, Nakajima says that it's enough to consider these FQs for very special choices of Qs, which are the line bundles O of minus one on the exceptional curves, and then the line bundle O on the union of the exceptional curves. So he even gives us an explicit choice of Kovshiv's Q that we have to consider here. If you give me an arbitrary surface S, I don't know what particular choices I have to take. So it's all up in the air.
Clear five-dimensional Higgs theory interpretation of all these iterations.
I'd like to see it. I mean, I never hit the Hashif two instant on kind of vocabulary.
This K theory should be the space of states of the five-dimensional Higgs theory.
So,
with operators, the W operators acting instant on particles.
So even at the basic level, I mean, it's not really clear to me what these particular our operators would look like on the moduli space of instantons. I mean, you would need to take an instanton, which is a vector bundle with a connection, and probably it stays the same vector bundle, but you change a connection somehow to give these operators here. And I don't think anyone has done the computation. I mean, even in the basic case, which was studied by these people, when instead of a full flag like this, you only have two sheaves, F0 inside F1, I am not really sure what the gauge theory interpretation of that is in terms of instantons, like precisely.
But I guess one can give correspondences for the ADHM.
Yeah, right. I mean, it has to. You have to explicitly pass this through ADHM and back.
Yes, yes, yes.
And
absolutely. But this.
And for a general surface, you have to unwind Donaldson's work, I guess, or I could apply it not once, but twice.
Might be inevitable because now these instantonic particles are. Something extra you put on top of the fundamental Higgs theory somehow. The fundamental Higgs theory has some. It's not a full definition of a theory. But still, these are clearly Hecke modifications, right?
Right.
Two operators.
But I mean, I still have a lot of reservations as to how to properly define these in general. So this is all far from being completed.
I have a question for David, actually. So this Carlson Kunz of extra operator is clearly like a 4 times. So does the Hanani move tell us anything? Is this what the
Right, so one thing that should be, there's definitely a lot of relations between AM and between the A's and F's. Yeah, I mean, this very relation could be some kind of a Hanani with them.
That would be cool. Because that Hanani wouldn't be visible at a D2, moving a D2 past minus 5.
No, that's fine. That's perfect too.
Which is, again, the D2 generates the Hecke transformation.
And then there is another relation, which is that somehow, if you specialize the parameters of the A, you should be able to get the F.
Oh.
Higgsing.
Oh, because
you're moving the answer. Yeah, more like the F should be a simple quotient of the vector operator to get by specializing A to some bodies.
Mm-hmm. So you would specialize the M.
This right.
Uh-huh. I mean, I guess when M is trivial, and you expect the operator AM to be supported on a locus of pairs of sheaves which are inside each other. And then if you take the components of that, then you would imagine to see a whole family of operators FQ.
Yeah.
probably that's what it means algebra geometrically.
And then you just split out which
one. Yeah, and you split out the, depending on a choice of first and second turn classes.
Which might help prove at least that FQs have the better separated property, FW.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
As well.
I mean, even that property for the interaction between FQ and the Ws is not very clear to me because in an intersection theoretic way, it's not really clear how to define these maps. We can make some guesses, but we're not sure if they're the correct ones. So.
Might even wonder if you can really live to the K-theoretic.
I don't know. I mean, if you can make them to be well-defined, it's not obvious. So first of all, if you want to introduce these kind of operators which modify a sheaf along a whole curve, you have to abandon the study of the moduli space, which is smooth, and study the moduli stack of sheaves. And then you have all sorts of other complications. So if you do the moduli stack of sheaves, these kind of operators here need not be well-defined. So if you see, if you stare at this, it's an infinite sum, and I never explained why this infinite sum converges. This infinite sum converges because for stable sheaves, the second Chern class is bounded below. But if you replace the world of stable sheaves by the world of all torsion-free sheaves, you don't have this property anymore, and in that case, the WNKs will explicitly be infinite sums of operators. And it's not really clear how to make that precise in K-theory. So there's all sorts of technical pitfalls which go into that case, unfortunately. Thank you very much.